From Nashville and Charlotte, this is the Shrink Tank Podcast. Each week, our panel of shrinks takes a look at pop culture through the fascinating lens of psychology. I'm Dave Verhagen in Nashville. I'm a psychologist, author, Comic-Con panelist, and cat behavioral consultant. And today, we're going to talk about I Changed My Mind, How Personal Experiences Change Strongly Held Opinions. That's in our second segment. But first, let's meet our Charlotte panel. He's a psychologist, author, AspieCon founder and Comic-Con panelist. He's also author of the popular Max Gamer graphic novel and book chapters on the psychology of Star Wars and The Walking Dead, among others. It's Dr. Frank Gaskell. Hello, Frank.
Hello, David.
Anything interesting in your world these days?
No, just still laying low and staying calm and doing my thing. I'm still feeling good.
Wow, this is like several weeks after sabbatical and you're still like almost a sane person.
Almost. Yeah.
He is most of the week, but on Fridays when we've gone out to get lunch, that really has distressed him.
Yes.
That has undone a lot of good work.
That is true.
Why is that?
Well, a lot of bad things seem to be happening when we go to lunch on Fridays, and I kind of came undone a couple weeks ago when things just didn't go exactly the way I thought they should.
Because if there's one thing that merits like losing it, it's going getting lunch.
Well, it's a little more complicated.
I don't think
so
it is.
Well, like the restaurant we were going to doesn't exist anymore. And then there was a...
Like you said, it's going to get lunch.
Yeah,
so
that's it.
What we're saying is this is a fragile truce right now.
Yes, it is somewhat
health.
Fragile.
Very delicate.
Okay. Very, very delicate. Also, you just heard her. Dr. Emma Kate Wright is here. She has a PhD in psychology. She's a contributor to ShrinkTank.com. She's been a panelist for Heroes Con. She's an all-around good egg. Hello, Emma Kate.
Hi there, Dave.
Any news in your life?
Well, given that it is the month of October, I am obsessed with Halloween. And I'm also a little afraid because Frank, Dr. Gaskell, has this thing that he does where he scares the living daylights out of me. And actually, right before we started filming, I was using the restroom. I came out of the bathroom, and I almost died because I was so afraid. So, yep.
She would have peed her pants, but
thankfully, I had just peed, so I was okay.
So that was
so
very considerate of Frank.
Yeah. Honestly, you should be grateful that I waited. Thank
sure.
you.
Thanks, Frank.
Yeah, you should thank Frank for
that's
that.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep.
Well, you also heard him. Jonathan Hederle's here. He's a licensed professional counselor, an expert on substance abuse treatment. He's our certified Asian on the panel. He's written book chapters on the psychology of Game of Thrones, Star Wars, and Walking Dead. And he's also served as a panelist for Heroes Con and Wizard World Comic Con. And Jonathan, what I realize is we don't get to hear about you in this early segment. So any news in your life these days?
You know, a lot going on in Korea, you know, Asian stuff, you know, dry cleaning, violin practicing.
Oh, no.
SAT
oh,
prep,
no.
you know.
This is not.
No.
iPhone
no.
making.
No.
This is why you don't ask.
Golly, man.
That's exactly why I don't ask. Well, each week, Jonathan rounds up two great stories of psychology in the news for our first segment that we call Being Human.
So Saturday Night Live just premiered this past Saturday, but earlier in the week, cast member Pete Davidson opened up to Marc Maron on his WTF podcast about his mental health issues that he thought were caused by his excessive marijuana use. But while at rehab, Davidson was told he may have bipolar disorder, but it wasn't until after he left rehab and had an episode, which he describes as just snapping, that a psychiatrist actually diagnosed him with borderline personality disorder. So, Emma Kate, isn't borderline associated more often with women than men?
So that's actually not true. And I really am so proud of him for being open about this because borderline personality disorder is one of those disorders that carries a lot of stigma. And there's just for those who are not familiar, there's a strong, intense fear of abandonment, and that can be real or imagined. Things are very black and white in terms of how they think. For men, there's a lot of substance abuse that can kind of become morbid with this, and post-traumatic stress disorder. So a lot of trauma tends to be something that can exacerbate and facilitate the development of this. But so trauma oftentimes, for men at least, you know, when they come in for treatment, which is not as often as women, because women are more prone to seek help, when men come in, they tend to be focused more on the substance abuse that can come with this and the aggression. Versus women, there's a lot of eating disorders and other types of self-harm. So I'm just so excited that he's being open.
I will tell you, his history is really interesting. His dad was a first responder at the World Trade Center in 9/11 and died. And so he marks that as kind of the turning point in his early life. I think he was maybe 7 years old, something like that. And so his whole experience, he said, was dad was here one day, then he's gone, and there's no good explanation for why. And so something like that legitimately can set somebody on a trajectory of forming some patterns in their personality that might end up like this. Really, when we think of a personality disorder, we really talk about long-standing patterns of relating that are problems. So like a narcissistic personality disorder, not to name names, not that we know any prominent people in the American landscape these days. But that's something that's part of how a person is put together, their personality. It's not the same kind of mental illness like schizophrenia or something like that. It's just how your personality is constructed. So borderline personality disorder is usually something that starts early in terms of how someone's personality is formed, and then really looks the way he's describing it as a young adult.
You know, even though he's, what, 23, 24 now, I'm encouraged because even though they thought maybe this was bipolar or this was related to his marijuana use, a lot of the borderline clients that I've had, they tend to be in their late 30s or older, and they'll just talk about years and years of misdiagnosis or being told it's something else, and oftentimes just having difficulty finding some level of relief from understanding the patterns that they establish in their lives, or just self-medicating.
And this is really the early days of male celebrities coming out as saying that they've been diagnosed as borderline personality disorder, largely because, like you said early on, it's been thought to be primarily a female personality disorder, primarily. And so we're seeing there was a football player in the last couple years that acknowledged it, Pete Davidson. So it's a good step because it allows people to understand it and to seek treatment, and so good for him.
Yeah. Well, moving on, a lone gunman opened fire at a music festival in Las Vegas this week, tragically killing at least 58 people and injuring hundreds of others. Now, we assume the world is safe and predictable. At least that's what a lot of psychologists are talking about, how trauma can impact everyday folks in the aftermath of a mass shooting like the one in Vegas. Specifically, traumas and mass shootings challenge the assumption that the world is safe and predictable, that the world is just and meaningful, and that the world is benevolent or people are inherently good. So, Frank, how do you think the recent mass shooting in Vegas tends to impact everyday people?
Well, it's like what you just said. It impacts your underlying beliefs, that if you to believe those things, that the world is safe and you're good and the world is good, it's not necessarily true, but it's a healthy way of living. It's a healthy way of kind of moving through space. Because if you don't buy into that, everything is a danger. And everywhere you look is a danger. And you start changing your behavior, you're not going to walk down that path. And this actually, these kinds of stories, I mean, they affect me, but they don't change me a whole lot. I was just driving around the other day, and I found myself looking up at the buildings, and I never do that. I'm thinking, you know, when would this happen to me? Is this going to happen somewhere else close to me? Am I going to be affected by this? And it's a scary thing, but we can't live our lives in that manner. And what this article talks about is you have to kind of reframe and get back to the way you view the world by like helping children who've been abused or giving yourself to others to try and not get stuck in that trauma.
And I do feel like for those who actually have experienced the trauma and gone through something terrible, regardless of what it is, there's a cool line of research by Richard Tedeschi and Lawrence Calhoun. I believe I've talked about it before, but it's called post-traumatic growth. And it's essentially, you know, when you experience trauma, you change in three ways, either through a sense of kind of change in self, where you realize that you're stronger than you thought you were potentially. People's relationships change. So sometimes you get deeper with someone else, or you lose people that you realize are no longer important. And then your life philosophy kind of shifts too. And so I feel like when these sorts of events happen, it's devastating for those that are directly impacted. And, you know, when I heard about this, you keep hearing about these horrible events and you think, holy crap, it's that many people. And then I started to read about some of the families and the victims. And it's just, you hope, the only thing you can do is just hope that they find a way to grow from this awful event.
Now, Dave, a couple of weeks ago, you actually wrote for Shrink Tank about your experience at a recent music festival. So in light of something like this, does that have any impact on you to where you would ever second guess or be more ambivalent about going to an outdoor music festival?
I've thought about that because I went to Pilgrimage Festival, which was here in Franklin, Tennessee, right down, literally down the road from Nashville. And there were about 25,000 somewhere in there at the festival. And the answer for me is no. I don't think I would stop going. In fact, I know I wouldn't right now. But it does make you think about it. I mean, it does put the idea in your head because you're realizing, you know, we're all out here in this big open field. If someone wanted to do something crazy, climb up in the sound booth nest that's, you know, three stories high and do something, they could do it. So I think for me, it wouldn't change it, but I totally understand the impulse to think twice about it, for sure. All righty, we're going to take a break, and we're going to actually keep talking about this topic in a different kind of way when we come back. Our trending topic is called Can You Believe It? I've changed my opinion about beliefs and whether someone changes their beliefs and their views, strongly held views, based on their own personal experience. So we'll take a break and we'll come back with that. This is the Shrink Tank Podcast.
Good psychology can change your life. At Psych Bites, we feature articles and videos with practical psychology that you can use every day. Psych Bites is a new psychology website with free articles and videos from dozens of the best psychology experts. Check it out on psychbites.com.
Welcome back to the Shrink Tank Podcast. I'm Dave Verhagen in Nashville, along with Frank Gaskell, Jonathan Hederle, and Emma Kate Wright in Charlotte. And our trending topic today is, I changed my mind. It's how personal experience changes strongly held opinions. We were just talking about the mass shooting in Las Vegas, the worst mass shooting in modern American history. And it's awful, awful event. And the stories that come out of there are both awful and they're amazing stories of heroism. But one of the stories that's come out, and this, it's interesting that this theme comes up about every time there's a shooting like this. At least one of the people involved, a prominent person, a guy named Caleb Keeter, who's a guitarist with the Josh Abbott Band. He was strongly a Second Amendment guy, very pro-gun, and he survived this event. He saw all that went down, and he's changed his opinion about it. He said, basically, I apologize for the position I took before, and I'm going to start now to take a different stance. And we've seen that in many different ways, too. Like, I'll give you a couple other examples. Ted Cruz was very extraordinarily conservative with federal disaster relief when it came to Sandy, Hurricane Sandy, up in New Jersey area, New York, and was very opposed to, voted against it, the disaster relief package. And then as soon as the hurricane hit Texas, then he is all about it. Another senator, Rob Portman, was a very anti-gay marriage and not a proponent of gay rights, in the at least in the way we've been thinking about that. And his son came out as gay, and he's done an about-face on that. Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, said that she changed her mind about gay marriage after she had dinner with a lesbian couple. So the whole idea is, here are these people that have these very strongly held views, whether it's on Second Amendment and gun violence, it's on you know, how federal money should be used, on gay marriage, you name the issue, and then they have a personal upfront and close experience with it, and they change their mind. Any thoughts about that, just in general? Emma Kate, you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I can relate to this in terms of the healthcare debate. I know it's not about guns at the moment, but there's been so much controversy over what we're going to do. And as a cancer survivor, I had cancer in college. And, you know, I think about all of the difficulties that go hand in hand with something like that. And when you're not directly affected by something of that nature, it is hard to relate and to understand it. And so I see why this is challenging for people, kind of bringing it back into the guns, where, you know, if you want to have a gun, that's absolutely part of your right as an American. But the reality is, people are coming out and saying, oh, well, you know, one man did all of this, and other people that probably had guns couldn't do anything. And so, you know, the argument that's often used to support the Second Amendment isn't quite valid when it comes down to it. And so when people are faced with that, you know, they deal with some sort of trauma because of guns, it becomes a different story. And so, again, it's that separation. It's really hard for people to connect and really understand what's happening because they can. And I don't think it's fair for us to expect people to really get it.
Yeah, maybe I'm a cynic, but with all those examples you gave, Dave, I tend to read each one a little bit differently in what I think's going on. For the musician, the guitarist that was out in Las Vegas, I mean, that really is about oftentimes the folks that are strong gun rights proponents, they champion like safety and freedom, and they witness that both of those are shattered. In terms of safety. In fact, if it's the same person that I read his account, like his band, they had weapons in their trailer, but they recognized,
yes,
like, we can't get those because police will not be able to distinguish us between the shooter. So it was completely useless to have firearms at that point. And so safety at that point in his mind trumps the freedom of the Second Amendment. Right. And so I think he, more than anybody, was exposed to firsthand trauma and devastation. I think Ted Cruz, and maybe this is my cynicism, that's really about political self-preservation. So it really is about serving
his— It's more expediency.
Yeah. And serving his own interests. I wouldn't be surprised, given Ted Cruz's track record, if he'd show sort of lack of empathy in other areas if it doesn't have some type of self-serving kind of component for him. The gay marriage issue really is about personalization. It really is about humanizing. It's so easy to have a principle detached from real life people, but when you come encounter with something that actually impacts people's lives and you listen to them, and you see them as a person rather than a political issue, I think everybody has the ability to change their mind.
You know, I I have lived a very sheltered life.
What?
And so I don't think a lot of my opinions have changed a whole lot based on being exposed to something. And this is not exactly the same, but people's perception of Muslims, the Arabic world. I grew up in Iran for a significant period of time, and every time somebody's like, "Oh, well, the, you know, Iranians are terrorists and all this kind of stuff," it drives me crazy because that's not who those people are, and it's because I was with them and I was able to be friends with them and understand their culture. But because of how far we are and where the politics are, nobody will have exposure to that kind of relationship with them. So that it's to a certain degree, it comes back to these silos that we're in. That's why I don't think this mass shooting will change anything. People are not open to change and open to new experiences. And I'm not saying being open to a violent attack, but just being exposed to something that is different that allows you to change your opinion, I don't see it happening.
Frank, I think I can think of one big picture issue that you have changed your mind on, I bet.
Using the toilet in public? Yes.
Well, you have changed on that.
Yeah, that is true, thanks to the iPhone.
That's what we call post-traumatic growth right there.
Yep.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Yeah, but other than that, I bet you have changed your opinion on gay marriage.
Oh, 100%. I remember.
All right.
This was now 17 years ago. You and I were actually in Dr. Ishii's office, and we were asked specifically, would you support gay marriage in North Carolina? And the answer was like, well, no, not really. I mean, maybe some legal avenue, but not call it marriage. And I'm 100% way 180 degree on that too. And I think that's right. Also so, been my exposure to having a variety of friends.
And clients and so on. I mean,
yes.
That's been for me the case. It's like as you get exposed to people, hear their story, and have clients that tell you. I mean, it's hard to kind of keep the same position on something like that. So that's true. Jonathan, I'm going to ask you, have you had any big picture issue, gun control, gay marriage, federal spending, you name the abortion, name the issue. Have you had any major change of mind or heart over the years? And if so, what is it and why?
Like not eating dogs anymore?
Yeah. No, I've doubled down on that.
Oh, okay. My God.
Yeah. No, actually, I grew up in a fairly conservative Christian environment. And I don't know how much I've talked about this with our listeners. I actually went to a predominantly conservative Christian college, and I was studying theology and religion. And I don't really think I had very informed opinions about a lot of what we might call hot button issues around politics and religion. I just kind of was very lazy and just sort of adopted the party line, physical conservatism, conservative in terms of social issues. And it's really interesting. One of my college friends just recently reached out to me on Facebook because of some of my writings on Shrink Tank. And she was just curious of like, where do I fall in terms of spiritual or political kind of matters? And I just talked, I've really veered more towards being a centrist and even left leaning on some elements. And it really is about humanizing. All of my adult years have been about service and help to others. And when you put yourself in a position of caring for people and hearing their stories and hearing their suffering, it's really difficult for me to not adopt a perspective of compassion and advocacy rather than just what we might call status quo or orthodoxy, trying to preserve the past.
I want to come back to that in a second. Emma Kate, you already said something about healthcare. Any other issues like that that you've seen yourself change on?
I mean, that's the biggest one for me, I think, just because I was so directly impacted by it. And the reality is, we all think you don't really think about your own mortality until you're faced with it. And so then when you need healthcare to actually help you and it's not potentially there, I couldn't imagine what that would be like. So that's the big one, because I've grew up in a conservative family, but I was always taught to, really be open to opinions, and then in my studies for school and then just kind of life experiences by being exposed to a wide variety of people. I feel like I want to listen at least.
So, Jonathan, you mentioned growing up in a very conservative Christian family and environment, and then later through exposure to people's stories and wanting to be helpful, began to see your views evolve. So how did that happen where you reconcile issues of your belief system, your faith, with new information and new exposure to people who have stories that might pull you in a different direction. How'd you do that?
Well, I mean, I think for me, like beliefs, whether it be in a higher power or spirituality, that they have to be able to find this really cool but nebulous intersection of like piety or values of something that maybe is unseen but has implication in real life people. And so any kind of belief that seems to serve this invisible unseen entity but creates a level of suffering amongst real life humans, it's very difficult for me to buy into or abide by. The other really cool thing about my evolving either beliefs, values, whether it be spiritual or political, is I'm incredibly fortunate that my daughters have played a huge role in my evolving beliefs. And for a lot of folks my age, I hear that they feel like it's just their role in life to instill all these values and beliefs in their kids. But I see the other side being just as prominent, as letting your kids influence you. And my daughters have really grown up in a world of diversity and openness and tolerance. And for them, for me, the idea of being in elementary, middle, or high school and having friends that are very openly talking about or struggling with sexuality or racism or, you know, prejudice, for me, that just I don't have any real life experience at that age to pull from. So when they talk about friends suffering or friends confused, it really humanizes it at a very personal level, and it allows me to feel compassion for my daughters. And it's been great to see how their lives have actually probably softened me and changed me in my beliefs about other people.
Yeah, my kids the same way. I can't tell half the jokes I used to tell, you know?
Oh my God. That's why he's so depressed.
So sad.
What a loss.
He's a better person, but he's more miserable.
Well, Frank, let me ask you this. Let's go the other side of this, because for every story of like a Caleb Keeter who went through this and then changed their view, there's another side to it. And there are people like Steve Scalise, the representative who was gunned down on the softball field. And he was Republican congressman and had very strong opinions about gun control or about Second Amendment and the need to keep the Second Amendment vibrant and guns accessible and so on. He's not changed his mind at all. And similarly, there are other people that have, even in this Las Vegas shooting, there's a story in Time magazine about a couple of folks that lost someone and they haven't changed their opinion about gun control at all. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that goes back to the article we were talking about earlier, mass shootings, that they have a worldview that says the world is dangerous and I have to protect myself. And so then this event happens and it proves the world is dangerous and I have to protect myself. They're either not flexible enough to come to another opinion, or it's just they look at the evidence differently and say, see, we need guns to protect ourselves.
Right. When your core belief is challenged, it can cause you to believe even more strongly in that belief.
Right. And it makes no sense at all and complete sense that after a mass shooting like this, you see stocks for guns go up and sales for guns go up, even though we're talking about how guns have contributed to the greatest mass shooting or the largest mass shooting in U.S. history.
What's interesting, I think what we're getting at, too, is ultimately this is much more psychological than people realize. In other words, it depends on how mentally flexible or rigid they are, how their worldview is and how they look at the world and select certain facts or not. Because I think people really do, whether they're on the right or the left, feel like they're holding truth and that their position is right because it's true and not just because it's influenced by their own personal psychology.
And that's why we're seeing that from Senator McCain, too, that I think he's realizing through his tumor that maybe he needs to change some of his views as well.
Yeah, definitely so. That's a great example. All right, we're going to take one last break, and when we come back, it'll be our final discussion. This is the Shrink Tank Podcast.
Hero House Publishing is pleased to announce Heroic Inspirations by Michael Kreitzer. Over the ages, superheroes in various forms have been speaking to humanity in togas, robes, and now tights and capes. They speak to us about the human condition. They help us work through our fears and failures. Heroic Inspirations draws out rich lessons superheroes provide for our daily lives. How does Superman teach us to deal with difficult people? What do the X-Men tell us about balancing individual and communal identities? Superheroes speak to these and many other life questions. Michael Kreitzer has been researching and teaching on superheroes for over 10 years, and now his book, Heroic Inspirations, is available to you at herohousepublishing.com or amazon.com. Order your copy today.
Welcome back to the Shrink Tank Podcast, and we wrap this all up with a final discussion about the legendary Tom Petty, who passed away recently. And Jonathan, were you a fan of his?
Well, I was actually a casual fan growing up, but it wasn't until my adulthood, about 10 years ago, that I really connected with his music, and I was able to really appreciate his musical talent, and I would say the genius behind his music.
So give us a sense for those who don't really get his genius. And I think, by the way, most people who appreciate music tend to appreciate him. But for those who don't, what made this guy a musical genius?
Well, the more you look at his career, it spans five decades. And during that time, you had punk, new wave, 80s synth pop, grunge music, and alternative rock, just to name a few. And yet, at any of those periods, you can instantly recognize a Tom Petty and Heartbreakers song. And he really boiled it down to the core essentials of almost like the early days of rock and roll, like verse, chorus, incredible catchy hooks, 3-minute songs. It's deceptively simple in a lot of ways. It's almost like Hemingway-esque in his lyrics, to where when you think about the 60s, there was this movement where like great lyricists would give you tongue-twisting, obtuse, and very inaccessible lyrics, where he just was able to write about loving a girl and wanting to stay young forever. And every generation can relate to that. And so he took sort of the blueprint of Buddy Holly and the Beach Boys, married it with the melodies of the Beatles, added a little garage fuzzy guitar like the Stones, and it's just something that everybody can find very hummable and memorable.
His hair kind of freaked me out a little bit.
That's Frank's contribution. Yep.
Yeah, right.
There it is.
There we go. Thank you, Frank. Jonathan, have you written anything for Shrink Tank about it?
Yeah, I did. It should be up, and it's really titled, basically, that Tom Petty is maybe the last great rock and roll icon, because he really does come out of the birth of rock and roll. He was inspired. He actually met Elvis Presley when he was 10. He decided to become a serious musician after seeing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. And so you can kind of hear in the DNA of his music some of that early birth of rock and roll, and it's something that even in today's manufactured pop sound sometimes gets lost. But again, at any point you can identify a Tom Petty song.
All right, and that's on shrinktank.com. All right, we hope that you will check out Jonathan's article on shrinktank.com, and that's going to do it for this edition of the Shrink Tank Podcast. And make sure that you check us out on Twitter at @shrink_tank and like us on Facebook by searching for the Shrink Tank Podcast. Our producer and theme music composer is Sean Beck. In the Queen City, it's Emma Kate Wright, Jonathan Hederle, and Frank Gaskell. And from Music City, I'm Dave Verhagen. Thanks for listening. Please tell all your friends about us and make it a good week.
Shrinktank.com.